Hello, welcome to The Quest. My name is Alan Mulhern. We have now finished our mini-series on the climate crisis. I wish to pass on to the obvious elephant in the room, the origins of destructiveness in the human psyche. Not least as it is expressed towards nature itself. You may benefit by picking up on two earlier podcasts on the origins of evil, episodes 84 and 85. This is the third in that series. Rather delayed, but this is the type of subject that won't go away. Business civilization has influenced and shaped the human psyche in ways which are partly conscious and partly unconscious. It has produced human beings immersed and dependent on technology, who are one-sidedly rational, that is, cut off from their emotions and intuition, highly engaged with consumption, increasingly removed from nature, very materialistic, and view nature as solely a resource to be exploited. Most of these values would have to be radically changed if the ecological crisis is to abate and not destroy us. Business civilization now comprises practically all countries across the globe, regardless of ideological orientation. Beyond the values, beliefs, and attitudes embedded in business civilization that have led to our current crises, the psychoanalytic view from the deep unconscious is explored to see if there is any explanation for our extraordinary attack upon nature. I find that there is agreement across many thinkers, from Freud and Carl Jung to Melanie Klein and Stanislav Grof, to mention a few, that there is a deep destructiveness at the root of the human psyche, as well as an equally powerful love and creativity. This is rooted in our traumatic separation from the womb of nature, which is to say, the very birth of our consciousness. I wish to examine, if only briefly, two sets of theories that deal with the unconscious to see what light they throw upon the psyche of Homo sapiens. The first is the social unconscious, and is more to do with collective values, and beliefs, and attitudes, such as those of business civilization. And the second is depth psychology, which examines chiefly the unconscious of individuals and generalizes from that. We can ask if these theories also throw light upon the attack of Homo sapiens upon nature. The human psyche, especially in its attitudes, beliefs, and morals, does not stand outside of civilization, but is deeply shaped by it. In turn, the collective, that is, society at large, is deeply influenced by changing beliefs and values. For instance, religious revolutions have had enormous impact upon the civilizations they have emerged within, such as Christianity upon Europe after the collapse of the Roman Empire, that of Islam on the Middle East and North Africa, that of the Protestant revolutions in Europe that played a major part in the emergence of capitalism. Protestantism was particularly suited to the spirit of capitalism, that is, the prevailing beliefs, attitudes, and mentalities necessary for the development of this economic formation. It was particularly in Calvinism that we find such predisposing traits, for example, individualism, rationalism, a calculating mind, the importance of economic vocation, a sense of destiny, the validity of money-making and usury. The relationship between the civilization and its value and belief systems is then an evolving dialectic, one influencing the other across history. They co-evolve. Capitalism has been the most inventive and revolutionary economic system in the history of mankind, and its technologies have transformed the consciousness of those that adopt them. Business civilization is a term which I have used to loosely describe capitalism of the late 20th and 21st century, but beyond that, it includes systems of all ideological orientation. Communist systems like China have adopted free markets, that is, capitalism. Most socialist countries have adopted some compromise with capitalism, valuing its free market dynamics and its ability to create prosperity. And even those countries which are most hostile to Western values still adopt crucial elements of the capitalist system. I would just prefer to call all of these business civilization. There is a wide spectrum of beliefs, values, and attitudes that are unconsciously or semi-consciously embedded in the populations of business civilization, now stretching, as I said, across the globe. And it is many of these values that must change if the ecological crisis, for example, is to not destroy us. We don't just require some new technologies to solve our problems. The ecological catastrophe, considered in its entirety, requires a deep change in the mindset as well as in our economic behaviour. Let us look at some examples of how business civilization has shaped attitudes, beliefs, and values that are partly conscious and partly unconscious, so as to eventually damage our natural world so badly. 1. The removal from nature. All technologies, social structures, and economic systems separate mankind from nature. Capitalism, however, has done this more radically than any other previous formation. 2. A materialist view of the world. Capitalism is a supremely materialist system. The combination of science and wealth convinces those in advanced economies that a materialist and scientific view of the world is correct. The superstitions of the past are rapidly abandoned. Nature, indeed almost all life, is there to be exploited. 3. The Age of Reason. This new materialist consciousness is more rational than any previous ones and inclined to the economic view, and by its technology and science emphasizes the supreme importance of reason and calculation. We are thus increasingly removed from the world of nature, instincts, emotions, and subject to the mindset required by current and profitable technologies. Competition forces the pressure. We must not only serve the machine, but must think like it. In addition, our societies are dominated by the evolving technologies which transform our landscape and our relationship to nature. For example, mass urbanization. 4. The abandonment of the religious outlook. The prevailing temperament of the system, business civilization, being allied to modern science, became anti-spiritual and anti-religious, leaving mankind empty, or, to use Weber's term, disenchanted. Nothing is sacred, including nature, and especially there is nothing sacred in the human being, no soul and no God to refer to. 5. There is a cult of the individual, but one that is in psychological and collective conformity to market values. There is a dominance of the economic view of societal relationships. Money relationships are dominant. The nexus of human relationship increasingly becomes based on money, which reduces an individual's identity to an economic value. Nature is another commodity to be exploited. We are not related to nature except in a monetary manner. It's there for our consumption, or to be used to our advantage, especially that of profit. 6. Wealth creation and enjoyment. Pleasure. There has generally been a rising tide of wealth upon which billions of people have risen. Growing wealth creates new consciousness, a sense of mastery, entitlement, increasing pleasure and happiness, as well as a belief that what one is doing is justified. Consciousness and its value framework thus becomes captured by the success of the system, and the values and morals of capitalism become dominant. However, this is periodically shattered by crises, of which the climate crisis, or financial crises, or a military crisis are major examples. 7. Consumerism. A great deal of the immense technological and productive forces of capitalism translate into consumption, the end goal of the system. Modern capitalist man and woman are then immense consumers, and this has profoundly influenced their consciousness, their apparent sense of mastery, entitlement, arrogance, and destructiveness. If you want to consume, you must destroy. 8. Technological supremacy. Technology has a deeply shaping effect on those who use it. Capitalism is the most intensive technological system that has ever existed. There is incessant technological competition driven by the search for profits, which, when reinvested, encourage more technological growth. This is the core of the system. These forces increase in business civilization and express themselves in computerization, artificial intelligence, and intense specialization, which provide ever greater exploitation of nature. 9. The economic system is driven by competition between firms and between nations, for example. Nature must be treated as another aid in the competitive race. It is not a thing in itself, but our aim is to enslave it to our appetites and our investment projects, which exercise power over nature. 10. The inner world of the individual, or the value structure of society at large, are scarcely capable of contending with a crisis such as the ecological catastrophe of our time. We do not possess the moral guidelines to cope or even understand it. 11. The age of information technology is the latest and possibly the most profound shift in the consciousness of humanity, which is becoming fused with digital and virtual realities. Many of the points mentioned above, the removal from nature, technological rationalism, intense consumerism, and so on, become more intensified with huge destructive consequences. 12. Specific sectional interests, for example, the fossil fuel industry and its vast lobbying influence, have the power to distort or repress the truth. Global populations can scarcely assess the true situation with respect to the attack upon nature, even supposing they would be willing to act on it. It is then such values as these that must change in order to avoid the severest consequences of the multi-dimensional crises of the 21st century, of which the climate is but one. Notice, this is a very different position to one that believes the roots of the problem lie in human nature. Rather, this point of view is saying how much the contemporary psyche has been shaped by contemporary society. If that is the case, then these values can change. But second, I now pass to depth psychology to see if there is something deeper in the human psyche that can account for crises we suffer, including the scale of destruction we are witnessing and causing. It follows that such deep determinants upon human nature are more difficult to change. We have already looked at some of the psychiatric classifications that describe business civilization and its impact upon nature, such as psychopathic, manic depressive, and so on. While these terms are very interesting, they describe certain aspects of this complex phenomena and miss out the positive aspects of business civilization, of which, let it be said, there are many, such as the rising standards of living and lifting billions of people out of poverty that has afflicted the human race for almost all its history. And think of the short lives, infant mortality, impact of disease, and the amount of misery in that condition. Along with the advantages of business civilization go the immense advantages of modern medicine, science, and technology. There is also considerably more freedom in advanced capitalism and higher degrees of education for the mass of the population compared to any previous system. But can depth psychology offer more to help us understand the nature of the human psyche, particularly in its destructiveness? Depth psychology refers to the psychology of the conscious and the unconscious. One of its first principles is that our conscious activity is underpinned by unconscious motivations and mechanisms. So, for example, is there a theory in depth psychology that can help explain what lies at the root of our attack upon nature? Are we unconsciously destroying nature? And what could be our unconscious motivation? There is a recurring theme among major thinkers in depth psychology, from Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung to Melanie Klein and Stanislav Grof, that comes under various names: the death instinct, the shadow, envious attack, to mention a few. It is very close to the idea of a malevolence or a profound nihilism in human nature. It is also consistent with a philosophy of a creative, destructive dualism in the human psyche, which I have explored in previous episodes. Freud, for the most part, detested metaphysics, the black mud of superstition that he advised Jung to avoid. He argued for a materialist science of the human psyche, which was to be based on the pleasure principle, except, of course, when it was frustrated or traumatized, which could lead to neurosis, depression, and aggression. He viewed civilization as indispensable for human beings, but it came at a price: repression. It was civilization that installed the superego in the human psyche, which could control the ego and its tendency to be dominated by its appetites, desires, and instincts, which he called the id. However, as Freud aged, he increasingly lent to the view, unwillingly, let it be said, that there was another layer of the psyche independent of the pleasure principle. At first he saw it in sadism and other psychological phenomena, but then he came to the opinion that it was a foundational or primary component of the psyche, which could be profoundly destructive when directed outwards, or when directed inwards it could lead to suicide. Not only did he see it in the psyche of his clients, but also in the horror of the collapse of European civilization. When the civilized mask came off, there was a madness in the psyche that was profoundly destructive. This he called the death instinct, though better termed a death drive. Thus, against all his previous reasoning, he arrived at a metaphysics, or at least a metapsychology, of an underlying duality in the human being, of the life and death drives or instincts, called by his followers Eros and Thanatos. Here we glimpse powerful concepts that can be used for our purpose. For example, that despite all our conscious economic calculus and our science, we are, in a remarkably short time, destroying the foundations of our existence. We are aggressively destroying nature. And although this danger has been now proved to us, we are incapable of taking proper action. There is, therefore, below the surface of an apparently rational and scientific civilization, something quite mad and dangerous. This destruction of nature is a projection of the death drive and its nihilist and aggressive components. Only greater self-consciousness, self-ownership and integration of our destructiveness can save us. It was Melanie Klein, one of Freud's most distinguished followers and publishing from the 1920s to the 1950s, who took this dualistic view of the human psyche back to the formation of the infant psyche, where this conflict between the life and the death instincts could be seen at its origin. This manifested as a primal battle, as it were, in the psyche of the child between the good and the bad breast. For the infant at first cannot see any whole person, but only perceives and connects to part objects or parts of the mother, especially the breast. From warm, even blissful connection to the good breast, the infant can be cast into despair and rage at being deprived of it. And deprivation in some form was inevitable. One of the most potent descriptions Klein was to give of the infant response to this was, envious attack upon the mother, at least in the fantasy of the infant. Melanie Klein described this first foundational stage of the development of the human psyche as the paranoid schizoid position, which is from birth to, say, 6 months, in which there is an anxiety concerning badness invading the psyche, as it were, an existential threat, which is felt as if from outside, but is really a projection of the death instinct of the child, believed Klein. The experience of the good object, the good breast, has not yet been internalized sufficiently, and therefore the emerging ego is not protected. It is full of anxiety, splits off the malevolent feelings and projects them out onto the mother, which then causes paranoia. This schizoid defense mechanism is a separation of the good and the bad object, to use a Kleinian term. The object not being a whole person, but, for example, being the breast. Klein took Freud's life and death instincts, or drives, very seriously, and regarded them as foundational to infant development, that is, as part of human nature. Once again, these ideas can prove useful if we substitute the concept of nature for mother. Paranoid humans rarely have enough satisfaction and are prone to feeling deprived. They are given to a type of psychological splitting, which is a defense mechanism in which badness is projected outwards onto others, or onto nature. Thus we have a scenario in which mankind is continually attacking nature in a battle with it, to try to feel more secure, to gorge on her surplus and destroy her in the process. It is the result of the deep unconsciousness of humanity and the inability to integrate its own malevolence into a balanced whole that is the source of the problem. Such a theory bears resemblance to the ideas of Carl Jung. In 1952, Jung published his most radical thoughts on the nature of evil in Answer to Job, in which he argued for a dualism in the Godhead itself, which he claimed contained both good and evil. Evil is the dark side of God. It was only human beings that split good and evil into opposites and attempted to put evil into a devil and goodness into a godlike figure. Human beings are possessed by these opposites that, as it were, they have acquired from their creation. Once again, human beings have to realize that the good and the bad, otherwise known as the shadow, have to be integrated and owned as one's own. Jung also argued that it matters not if you believe or you don't believe in the existence of God. Suppose you replace the term God with the term evolution. We have the same dilemma. Evolution, nature, the cosmos, contain both light and dark, life and death forces, the creative and destructive principles that are in nature and have formed the human psyche. Once again, we have powerful ideas. The creative and destructive are in the human psyche. We are unconscious of or deny our destructiveness with respect to nature. Humans bear the very opposites that they have acquired from nature, and we have to attempt to resolve and integrate them or perish. It is our unintegrated, malignant, destructive and unconscious shadow that is destroying the natural world upon which we are totally reliant. Stanislav Grof, born in 1931, still alive actually, initially used psychoanalysis in a most unusual manner. His patients, or volunteers, were at first given very potent psychoactive substances, particularly LSD, which were a catalyst of profound unconscious processes. Later in the 1970s, he switched to non-drug techniques with similar effects. He realized his subjects went through a central sequence of experiences of great intensity at first starting with early biographical experiences and traumas, as indicated in classic Freudian psychoanalytic practice, the early family environment, for example, the relationship with the mother, and so on. But then in these therapeutic experiments, regressing further back, these experiences went back to biological birth and even the womb. These experiences then were extremely explicit, as well as detailed, and had an intensity and even universality that was far beyond what anyone had thought possible. I paraphrase and quote from Richard Tarnas's book, The Passion of the Western Mind. Groff realized these experiences revealed a distinct archetypal sequence, the experiences of his patients, moving from a starting point of undifferentiated oneness in the womb to an experience of a sudden fall and separation from that primal organismic unity to a highly charged life and death struggle with the contracting uterus and the birth canal, and culminating in an experience of almost complete annihilation. Amazingly, this was followed almost immediately by an experience of sudden, unexpected, global liberation, which was typically perceived not only as physical birth, but also as spiritual rebirth, with the two mysteriously intermixed. Unquote. Groff concludes that the human psyche is rooted in an archetypal condition associated with the unresolved trauma of birth, in which an original, undifferentiated consciousness that was in unity with the mother and immersed in a participation mystique with nature has been disrupted and lost. There is therefore, on both the individual and the collective level, a profound split in the contemporary human between ourselves and nature, between mind and matter, a state of tragic separation of our experiencing self, our ego, from the world, from the womb of nature. Our very emergence into human self-consciousness is a fall from the Garden of Eden. It is a state of disenchantment of the cosmos and of being thrown into a universe of impersonal forces. Thus we experience the cosmos and nature as indifferent, hostile, and unknowable. We try to free ourselves from nature and the terror of death by attempting to dominate the forces of nature, attacking it, and even exacting revenge, a form of sadism. It was Francis Bacon, the father of empiricism and scientific inquiry, in the early 17th century, who declared, quote, "Nature had to be hounded and made a slave to the new mechanized devices. Science had to torture nature's secrets out of her." Unquote. Frightening words. It is an extraordinary thought that the origin of such feelings, voiced by one of the major representatives of the scientific enlightenment, Francis Bacon, actually have their source in the tortured psyche itself at its own birth, at its own separation from the great matrix of nature and the mother. At the root of the human psyche is a primal fear of death and the loss of control and dominance, a fear that lies in our separation from the womb of nature. Once again, the only answer is self-consciousness and integration, except that it is not an educational change of values that is required, but the deepest of psychoanalysis. The couch in depth psychotherapy is an invitation to a deep regression to the roots of one's conflicts, to listen to the unconscious, within which there can be a voice of healing and transformation. It is business civilization itself that needs to be put on the couch.